Welcome to NPR's roundup of its very best arts and cultural stories. I'm Zoe Chase. This week on Culturetopia, NPR's Lynn Neary hangs out with stealth celebrity and publishing phenom Chelsea Handler. The comedian's book tours were so successful, she just got her own imprint. Its first title, Lies That Chelsea Handler Told Me. A new Broadway play uses a soundtrack instead of a live orchestra. Musicians are furious, but sadly, the audience doesn't seem to notice. And the creators of Grand Theft Auto jump back 60 years with L.A. Noire. But first,
almost everything about Tayari Jones' new novel, Silver Sparrow, is cleaved into two halves. It's the story of two sisters. One is named Dana, the other Charisse. They have different last names, they lead different lives, but they share the same father, and they live in different parts of the same city. Their father, James Witherspoon, is a bigamist, which by definition means that he's a complicated man. And this is a complicated, heartbreaking, and very rich story about how secret sisters find each other, but lose as much as they gain in the process. Tayari Jones joins us here in the studio to talk about her latest book. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, I feel like we should clear something up right at the get-go, because I bet a lot of people read this book or read about this book and wonder if you yourself have a secret sister.
That's so funny. You know, when it comes to memoir, we want to catch the author in a lie. And when we read fiction, we want to catch the author telling the truth. I would like to say that my father is not a bigamist.
So this did not spring from your own family history. Where did the story come from?
Well, you know, I do have a sister. I have two sisters. They're not secrets, though. They're about 10 years older than me, but they didn't grow up with me. They're my father's daughters, and we have different last names, and we live different lives. We don't have that web of secrecy between us, but I've always felt that I had a sister that was just outside of my grasp. And so I started thinking about this idea of sisters and secrets. And then I was in a bar once with some friends having happy hour, and someone mentioned one of those stories you hear all the time about a man who dies and then two wives show up at the funeral. And so when I thought about that and I mixed it with my own wonderings about my own family, boom, this came together and the story was born.
You note in the novel how common this is, so common that most churches have smelling salts for the widow who thinks she's the only wife when the second wife shows up.
Oh, it happens all the time. But even more common than that is this idea of what I used to call half-siblings, until my nephew said, don't say half. He said, there are no half people. My mother's your sister. She's not your half-sister. And I realized that so many people have fathers who have other children, even if it's not simultaneous and in a bigamous relationship. Or I was giving a reading in Florida and a woman had me sign her book, and she said that on Father's Day, she had written on her Facebook status something like, you know, Happy Father's Day to the greatest dad in the world. And she had seen her sister's Facebook page, and her sister had written, I never had a father because the coward wasn't there. It's the same man. So what does that mean?
Help us understand the title of this book. What does Silver Sparrow mean?
Well, Charisse thinks of a silver girl as a girl who's better than she is. Kind of a, when I was growing up, I would have called a fancy girl. A girl who's lovely and popular and smart. All the things that your adolescent self feels that you are not.
And we should say Charisse is the daughter who is able to live in the open as the daughter of
James. Yes, she is the accepted daughter. And talking about this book, I've had to get all new language, because the impulse is to say legitimate daughter, but all people are legitimate. That's one thing this book has taught me, is that every person is legitimate. But Charisse, she doesn't think of herself as a privileged person. She doesn't know that her father has a daughter that lives in the shadows and feels unprivileged. She thinks she lives an ordinary life. She thinks she's just an awkward teenage girl. And then she meets this silver girl, Dana, who she thinks is the most beautiful person ever. So that's where I got silver from. And I took sparrow from the hymn, His Eye Is on the Sparrow, being the sparrow is the least among us. Because I think that's what Dana is. She is a silver sparrow.
And she's always looking at Charisse.
She's
with
always,
envy.
With envy and with fascination. Because she wants in. She wants into that family. She wants to be a sister.
I want to ask you about James.
Okay.
He's an interesting character. He is a bit of a Lothario. He's very seductive, but he's also deeply flawed and, as we said, very complicated. He stutters, and sometimes so violently that his whole body moves when he tries to speak. Is that the way he first entered your imagination? Did he stutter when you first heard him in your head?
Yes, that was one of the first things I knew about him, this stammer, because I thought a man like him to have two women, it would be such an interesting thing to say, how could he get two women? And I realized the same, when you get one woman, you get another one. And it also made him interesting, because I didn't think he should be so suave, like he's just, you know, a lady killer. I wanted each of his relationships to come from kind of genuine human interaction and need, like real need. He loves both these women. His crime is that he loves them simultaneously. But it's not that he seeks to use anyone or have notches on his bedpost. He actually has two wives.
I follow you on Twitter, so I know that you love Toni Morrison. You talk a lot about her influence on your work. As a writer and as someone who teaches writing, are you always conscious of the potential impact that you have on the next generation of writers?
I am interested in my impact on young writers, mostly about what I do in the classroom, not so much my books. I take mentoring very seriously, and I'm on the board of an organization called Girls Write Now, where we match teen girls and writing mentors because it changes their lives. And that's what I really think about, is helping other young writers find their voice. Because art, writing, story changes people's lives, and this is what we have to give, and we should give it.
Did it change your life?
Oh, no doubt. I was kind of an invisible girl when I was young. I was more like Charisse in my novel, and I never felt particularly special. I mean, I didn't have low self-esteem, but I never felt sparkly or that I had anything to say. And I went to Spelman College, and I met the president of Spelman at the time, Janetta Cole, and she had heard that I was a writer, and she once said to me, "How's the writing?" And it was like someone had touched me with a magic wand. And then I started taking my writing more seriously.
I'm a writer. Someone said I was a writer.
Yes, not someone. Janetta Cole said I was a writer. The most amazing person I had ever seen in real life said that I was a writer. And so I became known for it. And people started asking me, what did I think about this or that thing? Would I be willing to write for the school paper? It gave me value. I felt that I had something to contribute through writing. And I couldn't help but think, wow, what would happen if someone went to teenage girls in high school and said, you know, you have more to worry about than who's going to take you to the prom, because you have something to say that matters.
So you decided to spread some of the fairy dust yourself.
It's very important. And my organization that I work with, Girls Right Now, our girls all finish high school. 100% of them are going to college. The writing and the mentoring really has changed their lives. It's amazing.
Tayari Jones is the author of Silver Sparrow. Tayari, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chelsea Handler is a stealth celebrity. From her late-night perch as a talk show host on the E! Cable Network, Handler has built a sizable fan base for her brand of raunchy insult comedy. Handler also has a string of best-selling books, and they've sold so well that her publisher gave Handler her own imprint. Its first book, Lies That Chelsea Handler Told Me, has just been released. NPR's Lynn Neary has this profile of the publishing phenomenon.
When Chelsea Handler's last book, Chelsea Chelsea Bang Bang, was first released, the comedian-turned-writer accomplished something very rare. She had three books on the bestseller list all at the same time. Not only that, she beat Karl Rove to the top of the list.
When we found out that I got, you know, came in one and he came in two, my sister said, she called me and she said, "Do you think Karl Rove's just sitting in his study in his boxer shorts thinking, who the hell is Chelsea Handler?"
Handler's surprise at her own success seems genuine. Not so long ago, she says, she was doing stand-up at Starbucks. Now she regularly hosts celebrities like Will Ferrell and Jennifer Aniston on her talk show, Chelsea Lately. And she's known for quick comebacks in conversations with stars like Rihanna.
Hey, Asta.
Hi, cutie. How are you doing?
I like your dress.
I like your body.
As Handler tells it, she began thinking about doing stand-up comedy during a mandatory driving class after she was stopped for a DUI. She had to go in front of the class and tell them about her arrest.
I got up there and I told my story and how my sister turned me in and I was using her fake ID and how I called the cop a racist and he was white. We were all white, so nothing really made any sense. And people were laughing, and I just remember thinking, like, this is the best feeling. feeling. I mean, the instructor finally came and said, you need to get off the stage. And then I thought, wow, maybe I should do stand-up.
The youngest of six children, Handler admits she was a spoiled child, and her comedy does have a bratty kid quality to it. She likes to make fun of people and play practical jokes. On her show, she surrounds herself with a motley crew of regulars, including a Mexican dwarf named Chewy.
I don't even think Chewy knows what this holiday is. I'm guessing he thinks it celebrates his favorite condiment because he calls it Cinco de Mayo. So I'm left on my own to celebrate. Tonight, I will strap on my sombrero, fire up the blender, and spend the rest of the evening thinking about what's really important on this day. Why the hell Mariah Carey named one of her children Moroccan?
Handler says she first started thinking about writing after she read a book by humorist David Sedaris.
Before I read David Sedaris, I didn't know you could just kind of write disparate stories and put them together and have them be about whatever. So that kind of opened my eyes, and that's when I read one of his books. I thought, wow, I could do this. I could write like this.
Handler can be brutal about other people, but she is also brutally honest about herself. In her first book, My Horizontal Life, she mined her own sexual exploits for a laugh.
She doesn't play by nice girl rules.
Beth de Guzman is a vice president and editor-in-chief at Grand Central, a company which has published books by comedians like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. Grand Central published Chelsea, Chelsea, Bang Bang, and de Guzman says Handler promoted that book tirelessly.
Usually you try to make sure that celebrity will give you 2 weeks, and she came to us and said, I want to do a comedy tour, I want to do book signings, and it went on for months and months and months. So after we saw how good the book was and how committed she was to supporting the book, we knew we wanted to continue to be partners with Chelsea.
So when Handler's agent proposed that she get her own publishing imprint within Grand Central, the company said yes. That means Handler will not only write books, she'll also publish other writers' work. For the first book released by her new imprint, Lies That Chelsea Handler Told Me, Handler commissioned her oft-abused colleagues, friends, and family to write about the ruthless lies and practical jokes she has inflicted upon them over the years.
This book I just kind of oversaw and edited and kind of added stuff at the end of people's chapters and added a bunch of pictures. But this book to me is kind of like, it's kind of the end of the road as far as my practical jokes go, because I don't know who's ever going to believe anything I say again after this. It's like the girl who cried vodka.
As for the future, Handler says she'd love to discover a great comic writer, and she knows one thing. She wants to publish books that make her laugh a lot.
It's so relaxing to laugh really hard. I mean, there's no better feeling, even if you're not in on the joke, to see someone else hysterically laughing when they can't contain themselves. And we've all had that, where you really think you're gonna pee, you know? Like, you're laughing so hard, and you can't get it together, and you know it's totally inappropriate. That's what I want people to be doing.
When they read your books.
Yes.
Handler's not sure exactly what her next book will be, but she says her dog Chunk is working on his autobiography.
When Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, opened on Broadway in March, there were fewer musicians in the orchestra pit than union agreements normally require. The producers had won this concession over the musicians' objections. The dispute is still in arbitration, but the musicians have taken their case to the public. Jeff London has more.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, is a fun-loving, splashy $15 million jukebox musical filled with disco hits and lip-syncing drag queens. The show wants little more than to entertain Broadway audiences for a couple of hours, and it's been packing them in on a pretty consistent basis. So why were there eight concerned musicians standing outside the Palace Theater handing out leaflets before the show last Thursday night?
Please support the musicians on Broadway.
Bill Roden, a retired trumpet player who worked in Broadway pit orchestras for 40 years, thinks Priscilla, Queen of the Desert represents a threat to the very livelihood of his fellow musicians.
When you go into the show, you're going to hear the sound of strings coming through the sound system, but there's not a single string player in the orchestra. It's all been pre-recorded, and we are very concerned about the live tradition of Broadway and how it is being undercut here at this show.
For the first time in Broadway history, Most of the songs in a musical utilize a pre-recorded soundtrack, while nine musicians play along with the recording. Lead producer Gary McQuinn insists this is not about cost-saving, but aesthetics. He says the creative team wanted to emulate the cheesy sound of drag clubs in Sydney, Australia, during the 1970s and 80s.
It's a very kind of particular sound, and it's a sound that's actually, if you like, synthetic. We never wanted the lush orchestral sound. We never did want that. We still don't want it.
But Tino Gagliardi, president of Musicians Local 802, doesn't buy the argument.
There is no artistic reason why they had to record a whole string section and have it play along the way it is. There's only one consideration, and that, in my opinion, is financial.
And Gagliardi isn't only concerned that the show employs half the musicians that normally play at the Palace. He thinks it undercuts a very basic aspect of what makes a Broadway musical, a live orchestra.
It's not even a labor management issue as much as it is an aesthetic one. People, wake up. This is what's happening to theater. Okay, before you know it, we're going to be another Branson, Missouri. And I'm sorry, this is the capital, the Great White Way, for crying out loud.
Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me? Goodbye.
Producer Gary McQuinn says if the arbitrator rules in the union's favor, he'll abide by the decision. But he's still not going to change the show.
If this dispute got to the point where we essentially were forced to employ musicians, strings or otherwise, we wouldn't put them in anyway. They'd have to sit there doing nothing, because that sound is terribly important to us.
And McQuinn wonders why Local 802 has brought the dispute to the public months after the show is opened and while both sides are engaged in arbitration.
That feels to me like the 802 is actually trying to preempt the proper processes that are actually laid down in those industry agreements. I mean, they're outside our theatres handing out leaflets and picketing. That's just not appropriate in my view.
But after the show on Thursday, as happy crowds poured out of the Palace Theatre, most seemed oblivious to the brouhaha. It was the third time New Yorker Steve Cordovis had seen Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
It's amazing.
Were you aware of the musicians outside before the show tonight?
No, I wasn't.
They were protesting the fact that several of the songs are pre-recorded and the orchestra plays along. Does that bother you at all?
No, it doesn't.
Both sides expect arbitration to be decided within the next few months. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The Virgin of Guadalupe has been spotted on a piece of toast, a tortilla, and a griddle. Now she's shown up beneath a viaduct in San Diego County. Amy Isaacson reports on her latest less-than-mystical appearance.
It all started here on the side of a busy road in Encinitas, California. We're just a few blocks from the Pacific Ocean, underneath the train tracks. The story that's made its way around town is that on the Friday before Easter, a construction crew showed up.
Like around 12 o'clock during the day, so no one would notice.
They put cones out and stopped traffic in one lane.
It appeared, quote unquote, mysteriously.
That's Rachel Boring, Beverly Goodman, and Mary McCarthy. It was a 10 by 10 foot mosaic of the Virgin of Guadalupe. She's riding a surfboard, catching a huge wave. She's brightly colored, and down the side it says Save the Ocean.
It definitely fits with the whole beach city vibe down here.
Kyle Smith points out that Encinitas is a surf mecca. The mosaic is intricate and beautiful. The stones and glass the artist chose give the Virgin's face a sort of beatific look. Her hands even have stone knuckles. The problem is, the piece just appeared. It's illegal. Jim Gilliam is the city's arts administrator. He says the piece's guerrilla nature fits with the city's energy.
The chakras out in the ocean make this to be a vortex of creativity. And I think there has to be something legitimate to that, because this is definitely a community that draws creative people.
It qualifies for graffiti.
James Bond is the mayor of Encinitas. He says because the artist ignored the city's rules, allowing the piece to stay would set a bad precedent.
If I were an artist, I would think that anything I wanted to do, I could do anywhere I wanted to do it in the city. Because why? Because we left Madonna there, so why wouldn't we do that for everybody else?
Bond has received hundreds of emails about the mosaic. Most, he says, ask him to leave it be. But he says some caution that religious art has no place on public property. A few state that the piece is sacrilegious.
So it puts us in an awkward position.
St. John's Catholic Church is about a mile up the hill from the mosaic. Father Brian Corcoran says he loves the piece so much he made it the cover of a recent church bulletin.
I call her Our Lady of the Waves. If Our Lady of Guadalupe lived in Encinitas, she probably would be surfing.
Corcoran says a surfing virgin isn't traditional, but he insists it is in keeping with what she represents. And in this case, he says the message transcends religion.
It could be anybody on the surfboard, Che Guevara, Buddha, Muhammad. You want to save this world, you want to save the ocean, you want to make a difference in this world, you want to change the economy, you want to change our society, you have to get involved, get up and catch the wave.
The mystery of the artist's identity has Encinitas buzzing. A few people on the street suggest confession would be a good way for the person to come forward. Corcoran says that would not work.
That is between him and God, or her and God, whoever it was. No, for confession, you have to be able to say, I'm not going to do it again. That's tough.
Meanwhile, the city of Encinitas hasn't decided what to do with the piece. Officials are waiting on an art conservator to tell them if it's possible to move it. For NPR News, I'm Amy Isaacson in Encinitas.
A new video game offers up another way to experience life in the LAPD, circa 1947.
We'll get a commendation if we crack this murder code.
You sure the homicide squad won't step in and take the collar?
Even if they do, we play along, and who knows, we might get bumped up a desk.
That's him. Get him.
That's Cole Phelps, a returning World War II vet who's solving crimes and working his way up from beat cop to detective. In the much-anticipated L.A. Noir out this week, a player can step into the gumshoes of Cole Phelps as he pursues a host of suspects, from a dicey Hollywood movie producer to crooked cops. L.A. Noir is from Rockstar Games, the company behind the fabulously successful Grand Theft Auto video game franchise. For this latest game, the makers meticulously recreated Los Angeles of the late 1940s using old maps and photos from the time. Harold Goldberg is a video game scholar and critic who spent many hours already playing L.A. Noir.
It's a game that is very film-like, and it just feels, you know, like anything from Hitchcock to Scorsese. It feels like being in a film sometimes.
Walk us through a scenario of being the cop, Cole Phelps. What might he be doing?
So what you may be doing is being called to a murder scene, and you'll check out a body, trying to see if there are any clues on the body or nearby.
We had a shooting took place down this alleyway. I need you guys to try and recover the gat. Happy hunting.
You'll perhaps walk into the bar that's nearby and ask people, you know, did you see this murder? What happened outside?
But again, these are like, as in a movie, scenes, but you're in them.
You're deeply in it, and you know, sometimes you don't want to leave. I ended up in a diner on one of the cases, and I kind of wanted to sit there and order pancakes and not continue on my quest to find out why this devious Hollywood producer did what he did.
The gameplay itself, I gather, is a bit different from most games. Explain that.
The gameplay is a bit slower and more deliberate than in other games. So much of the game is interrogating suspects, and they have a new technology which captures faces so well that you're able to look at a face and decide whether the person is telling the truth or not. And the writing is often so nice that you feel like you're inside Dragnet or Law and Order or something like that. And there's a really nice dramatic arc with all of these as well that keeps it from being boring.
That would be because the writing is more important here than in previous games?
Yeah, well, Rockstar, the people at Rockstar have always been considered pretty good writers. And, you know, I think that this game is as good as some of our better Hollywood scripts.
Oh, really? Do you think so? That good?
Yeah, I think it's that good. I mean, there's been this for almost 20 years, you know, Hollywood and game makers have had this kind of uneasy relationship. But I think with L.A. Noire and a few games before this, game makers beat filmmakers at their own game, so that their writing becomes taut and witty, and it's really quite nice all around.
Well, then are they hoping that they'll bring in new people? That is to say, people who don't play games generally will find this one compelling enough because it's just that different or that literary?
Yeah, I do think so. And it's one of these games that's called an open world game, so you can kind of leave your current case and drive around. I mean, I checked out Pershing Square in L.A. from 1947 because it's an area that I know downtown L.A. fairly well. So it's really kind of fun. And there, you know, you have these 8 square miles of Los Angeles to check out.
How much of a gamble is it for the company, though, to go for maybe a non-gamer community? Would it maybe not have enough action for traditional gamers, and that could be a problem?
It treads this interesting line of being very accessible to a non-gamer and yet appealing to people who play games a lot. It's a big, big gamble. It's tens of millions of dollars. But I think they've done it right, and I think Rockstar also is kind of like the Beatles of video game companies right now. They seem not to be able to do anything wrong, so people will flock to something they put out.
That's Harold Goldberg, whose new book is All Your Base Are Belong to Us, How 50 Years of Video Games Conquered Pop Culture.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.